This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of July 4th, 2021, brought to you by First Person Advisors, a subsidiary of NFP. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Downtown Indianapolis seems like it's slowly getting back up to speed. Although I have to admit, I'm only down here during the workday. And actually, there's a story on the cover of this week's IBJ about when the major downtown employers plan to return to full strength, or whatever concentration of workers they think is appropriate in the post-pandemic marketplace. City leaders took a significant step last week toward accommodating a bigger workforce by lifting most social distancing rules and capacity limits, which in part means bars and entertainment venues could return to 100% indoor capacity. And that was the cue for the return of one of downtown's longest-standing and most culturally significant watering holes, the Chatterbox Jazz Club. Like nearly everything downtown, it initially closed in mid-March of last year, but owner David Andrichik chose to remain closed, even after COVID restrictions partially lifted. And as we'll hear in a moment, the economics of a partial return didn't make much sense for the club. If you've ever been in the Chatterbox, you know that the footprint is basically that of a passenger train rail car. It is not big. But it has played an outsized role in the ongoing rejuvenation and redevelopment of the Massachusetts Avenue Arts District, beginning when Andrichik bought the club in 1982, and its surroundings were pretty desperate, to say the least. Andrichik is now working toward reopening this month, so I thought this could be an interesting study of what reopening all entails for a small business and bar owner. Andrichik is now 70 years old, but I have to say, looks ridiculously fit thanks to his pandemic exercise regimen. The 16-month break also has given him the space to handle some significant personal losses, as well as to begin planning for how he will eventually step away from day-to-day management and what the club's future might look like. Here's our interview. I'm pleased to welcome David Andrichik to the IBJ Podcast. Thanks so much for dropping by the studio today.
You're welcome, Mason. Glad to be here.
And as we were talking before, it's fitting that we are going to talk about reopening businesses today. This is will be the first full edition of the podcast that I've done face-to-face.
Yeah, good.
Probably 16 months.
Wow.
So according to the Chatterbox Facebook page, today should be day 365 plus 109 of
correct.
The Chatterbox's safe social distance closure.
When
did you guys close?
That is correct. 16th of March. We have traditionally had a really great St. Patrick's Day sing-along on the 17th, and we did the rehearsal on the, the day before, 2 days before the 17th, and then everything just, you know, came down. It was real serious, so we closed. So we only got a rehearsal in, and Killeen is my music director, musician, and I paid her for that, but then we didn't have the gig in order to do that. So we tried a virtual one this year, which was fun to do. I learned new skills of doing that and coordinating on different video platforms, but it wasn't as fun, certainly. So we're looking forward to 2022, March 17th.
One of the things I thought was really interesting was that the Chatterbox maintained like a daily Facebook presence. I mean, to the point of saying, on this day, we would have had, say, Rob Dixon with Zach Cruz on drums. And your bartenders would have been Vanessa and so-and-so. Did you really have all that planned out? Is that literally a schedule, or are you doing some guesstimating?
No, totally planned. Yeah. Totally planned. And I asked all of my bartenders to give their pay app information, their Venmo or PayPal or whatever, so I could put that there. And then I encouraged the musicians that would normally be the lead musician on that evening to put a pay app there in the comments section and then share it to their people too. And, you know, I just kind of figured out that would work. And because I'm really diligent about taking photographs, I had photographs of everyone. who were playing mostly at the Chatterbox. Sometimes I put others in because I saw them other places, or they had photos that I utilized. But the idea was to just not let the presence of the Chatterbox spirit die and do it every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it also gave me something to do every single day that was business related.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was really effective. I kept thinking to myself, wow, when is this place going to reopen?
Well, and that's part of it, too. And, of course, initially, many of the people that saw those posts would contribute, and then it kind of dies off because, you know, what are we going to do? And the whole world was that way, and the country's that way, and we're happy now to plan our reopening.
So when is the date? Do you have a date?
Not a specific date, but it'll be in the month of July. Once they removed all of the essentially distancing requirements in Marion County. So capacity, space between persons, standing or not standing, space in front of the stage, all of that limited me to about 20 to 22 actual customers, two bartenders, three to five band members, so less than 30 people. I could have been open, but I could not have made money at that level at all.
Yeah, I wanted to dial down into that in more detail, because you could have reopened when a lot of other bars reopened, but you would have been severely limited due to, some space restrictions. Can you kind of go through that math exactly? If your capacity,
sure,
normally would be like 80.
Well, my seated capacity, critical, 50, 50. I had 10 tables and 12 bar stools. Now, one of the requirements was in front of the stage, you had to have a 10-foot gap before the first person. Well, that took out three tables and four bar stools automatically. And then it wasn't 6 feet between tables, it's 6 feet between persons. So it's about 8 to 10 feet between center table to center table. So you have a 3-foot table, 18 inches of a person, 6 feet, 18 inches of another person, and so on. So that would have given me maybe 4 of my 10 tables net, and then 6 of my bar stools. Well, it's crazy. I fully believed in that safety level, and now when it is safer and many more people are vaccinated, we're good to go.
So you would have, best case scenario, would have like 20 people.
20 actual customers, bartenders and staff, total number of persons less than 30. Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the critical things is we don't have a kitchen, so we are a bar/entertainment venue. We are not a restaurant, don't qualify as such. Board of Health doesn't qualify us that way. They inspect us because you have to have some food, but no kitchen, that puts us in a different category. And it was just, I think 2 weeks ago, they raised from 50% occupancy to 75. Well, I could have gotten no more people in with that, just because we're so tiny. I mean, we're from the bar edge to the wall is about 12 feet. And then from the other bar edge to the other wall is 6, so 18 feet inside, and it's 44 feet long to the restroom wall, which is the back wall. Mm-hmm. So it's like not even a bowling alley length of distance, and just a little bit wider.
So the numbers would not work.
No, not economically work. Right. And it was less expensive to be closed and pay those core costs of, insurance, and you got to have the alarm, and you got to pay some core water and sewer and some core electricity, but all of that was reduced.
Now, you had the patio outside. Was that an option? Could have you just done the
patio?
It would
have been, but of course it's weather dependent. And until now, in the spring, now summer, it wouldn't have been very usable. Plus, then you have to monitor the number of people that come in. If it rains, we're limited to 22 people. You can't walk in the door. Well, it's absurd. Now, I did not disagree at all with the regulations, but we didn't want to be the police element to police those regulations and do it. Now we're all vaccinated, all my staff is, and as far as I know, most all of the musicians are vaccinated. And so if people come in that are not vaccinated, it is totally their risk and not our liability.
Did you need to reopen by this point, or could you have gone for longer?
Could have gone for longer. I only wanted to wait until the regulations were changed. And, had I opened earlier, which I could have, I would have been allowed to, I don't think I would have survived, because I went through all the Chatterbox savings, all my personal savings, and am now into retirement savings to just keep it going. But it's still, again, way less. If I would have opened up, the cost would have quadrupled or more with no guarantee of that kind of income increase.
So, yes, but you found yourself in a pretty tenuous financial situation at this point if you're dipping into retirement.
Yeah. I was pleased, number one, that I was old enough to go onto Social Security. So that gave me my own life raft that I've been paying into my entire working life. And certainly my home, my condominium, that mortgage is paid off. So taxes and maintenance, that still goes on. But the big deal for mortgage was not critical. So
the things that you still would be paying for the Chatterbox business would be taxes. You mentioned alarm.
Property tax. Yeah, mm-hmm. Alarm insurance, certainly, because you have to insure the building. You know, even though you're not operating, it's still an asset in there. Their core cost for water and sewer, even though you're not using it, you have to pay it. Otherwise, you could certainly have turned it totally off. But then to reopen, it's a substantial maintenance thing on the pipes. And also paying attention to new deposits and new systems, and then it costs you way more to open back up again. So electricity is pretty easy because you're really not using much. So you're paying, yes, I paid for heat and gas and a little bit of electricity to keep it reasonably cool inside. And then some things, I did not let my beer coolers off. I mean, the beers, you got to throw it away, but nonetheless, those were still running and the deep freeze is still running. So there's minimal electrical. And that would have been, I wanted to keep that on for those reasons, to keep the space air conditioned at a certain level so it was reasonable.
And you own the building, the Chatterbox building.
So it's a different corporation.
Yes, right. But you were not paying rent to yourself.
Oh, yes.
You were paying rent to
yourself.
Yes. Okay.
Well, to the other corporation, because it has its own property taxes and utilities and so on and so forth. So, yes.
All right. Let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
First Person Advisors is now a subsidiary of NFP, the fifth largest insurance broker in the world. Your total reward strategies all in one place. The same local award-winning firm with global expertise and resources now in your backyard. Learn more at firstpersonadvisors.com.
Okay, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. Our guest is David Andrichik, owner of the Chatterbox Jazz Club, which is reopening after 16 months of COVID closure. Did you apply for any of the federal aid programs?
Well, initially, I actually am in process of doing it now. Initially, it was the PPE, and it was only for employees, and you had to keep them there. It's like, well, that's pretty absurd, because by Indiana law, Indianapolis regulations, I can't even be open. So it's like, what am I going to do? So I just didn't. I was able to get through, was it the musical family tree, and then now the shuttered venues thing, and one of the early small business association things, approximately total 18,000 in a couple of pieces, but then you had to document what you were paying for, those things that I just mentioned, and then you can't double dip. So you can't go back and say, well, I paid all this. Well, yeah, but you were granted some money. It was a percentage of that, I think about 75% or whatever. And it was federal money to state, to city, to these organizations that administered it, and then to the venues. And so it was certainly helpful, certainly helpful.
So what have you been doing for 16 months?
Staying healthy, doing Facebook posts, and communicating with, you know, my friends, my staff, the musicians, by virtue of that, because each time I did a post, there was also generally a comment, a personal message back and forth, you know, when are you going to open, what's going on, can we have our same space when we go back, that kind of thing. And so, you know, paying attention to that, paying attention to health. You know, just doing basic maintenance things around the house, you know, things like that. In this interim, late 2019, my father died, who was here, and then Mom survived through COVID, not getting COVID, but in an assisted living facility through November of 2020. So I lost both of them, which were, in other words, that was really occupying a lot of my time. So I'm working on estate stuff now. Now, neither died of COVID. Mom may have had the overlay of the loneliness of both losing her husband of 70 years and then not being able to see me except through a window of her room. She was well taken care of, but you're lonely and you have a level of dementia. She did. Still knew who everybody was, but then couldn't remember certain things quickly or recall that sort of stuff. That was both an emotional loss for me, both of them, and then, you know, having to deal with that. I'm the only kid in city here, so they moved here about 16 years ago. So
I'm sorry for your loss.
Yeah, thank you.
This may be a stupid question, but was there a little bit of silver lining in that you could have the time and space to deal with those deaths and those repercussions without having to go to work every day?
Yes, yeah, absolutely, without a doubt. Yeah, that certainly was. And, you know, a number of years ago, three years ago, we did a story with Bill Brooks of Urban Times about what my plans were for the future, since I think I hit 35 years Chatterbox anniversary and we're now at 39. I'm certainly thinking about retiring. And this gave me more time to think about what my life would be without having to do those tasks on a daily basis. What would I miss? What could I incorporate, you know, in a different kind of sale or whatever, and so on. So,
oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Did you end up making some decisions about what you're going to do?
Not concrete decisions, but there's been conversation that I've had with others that there's a possibility of creating a cultural not-for-profit, that the entity of Chatterbox and what it has done nurturing jazz music for musicians for so long, what it has done for that needs to be preserved. Now, the building, while it's part of a historic district and it called a contributing structure, it's not historic in and of itself, but it could help along that. So you could have a cultural institution, not for profit, within that building. And then that would have a different ability to do funding. It would have a board of directors. It would have other different things to be able to do and still maintain and sustain the cultural nurturing that we've done for all these years.
Wow. Would, in your vision here, would it not continue as a bar?
Oh, no, I think it would. I think it would have to. I mean, that's part of the whole cultural element. Now, I don't know the legalities of not-for-profit owning a liquor license, and maybe that's something that they just they're there and they're operating, or the bar operates and the cultural institution is wrapped around that or wrapped within that.
Yeah.
That part I don't know, and I haven't. Well, a number of people that have had those ideas and suggestions. One of the models that I'm working on and talk to Shannon Forsell is the Cabaret, and that is over in on Pennsylvania. They're 924. It's an old roller rink space that's there, and they're doing great things and have for the last number of years since they got to that specific space. And they are a not-for-profit, and I've talked to Shannon about that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of when you might step aside?
I'm thinking that could allow me to not step aside except for the day-to-day business. So the St. Patrick's Day sing-along, I could still do that. The Christmas sing-along could still do that. Do the Chatterbox Bowling League that we've done for 12 years, do that. Do the special events, the Beaujolais Nouveau party coming up in November, those kinds of things. If I could have a presence, maybe not even run that, just have a presence at those things, that would make me happy. I could do that. I could do that till I died. I'm sure.
Let me ask you about the staff. Pre-pandemic, I think you had maybe 8.
Correct.
Right. And these were all bartenders?
Yes. Everyone is bartender-server. They all do all tasks because we're so tiny. So if someone needs to have patties of Jamaica done in the little pizza oven, they do that too, and then do the drinks and so on. Technically, everyone was part-time. I was the only full-time person. So that was something that they had to sort of pivot and go and expand their other part-time endeavors when they lost the income of Chatterbox. And they did okay. I mean, no one did well. And a couple are not coming back because they found better jobs and couldn't fit us in. But if they can work in a shift on a weekend night or something like that, they're still going to do that. So we had our first in-person employee meeting this past Monday, and we had five people there plus me, six. So
you have five employees coming back?
Yeah, definitely five. Mm-hmm. And I've got asks out to former employees to see if they can. And that may mean that we're not open on a full schedule to begin with, which lots of places are doing. And we'll just have to roll with the punches. First is to get things cleaned up, get rid of the bad beer, get in new beer. I have to renew the liquor license in July, so that happens too. I mean, these are expenses that have to happen before the first dollar coming in the door. So this will be a big, heavy cost month in July.
Well, I was wondering, what are all the things that would be on your to-do list before you actually get to open up the doors?
Well, because the convoluted answer to your question, because I had to downsize all my parents' stuff, a lot of it is stored there, the balance, in the main bar space. And then I've had friends come through to look to see if they want it and then take the rest to Salvation Army or Goodwill or whatever. So there's still some of that left, not much, but still some of that left. And I've done some internal repairs to it as the landlord corporation. So that part is happening and it's in process. It won't be finished, but it'll be partly done and we'll continue.
You need to, I would assume,
restock.
I was going to get in touch with your vendors again.
Yeah, restock, correct.
And then do you have to sort of guess what, you know, your orders are going to need to be over the next first couple months?
I'll know what I throw out. You know, this many cases of beer. The wine is good because it's been stored in the basement. The liquor is good. It's sealed up. So only the open bottles will be thrown away or given away or whatever. So there's only technically beer loss as far as product. And then the frozen food, while it's still frozen, it's not good. It's been there for 15 months. So that all gets thrown out. And then we start from scratch on that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, make the loss claims, of the inventory.
When you were talking with your staff about reopening, what was the reaction? What kind of sentiment?
They're totally excited. Yeah. Totally excited to get back. Number one, it's a pretty good paying gig because people are generous around the jazz music. And we have diverse, lively music 7 nights a week. So they cherish those times, too. At different times of the day, like all bars, you have different profiles of customer. The after work group is older, like me, or a little younger, but they have great intellectual conversations and arguments and so on, whether it's on the patio or inside, and that's a whole different thing. Some stay for music, some don't ever stay for music because they're early to bed. But it's a whole different profile of customer. And then after music's done, another profile of customer, generally service workers that are coming in for the tail end of the music and after their shifts and that kind of thing.
What are you most concerned about right now in terms of reopening?
That the people will sustain, the customers will sustain and continue to come back after the original flourish. It's not my intent to have a big grand opening. It is to do a slow opening, word of mouth, Facebook posting, continue to do that. We're open now. Come on in. There's some changes, da-da-da-da-da. And that I don't want the new to wear off at the end of August, where everyone's like, okay, that's it. You know, or the other virus strains be so serious that the whole country has to change in a different way, or the state or the city. So those are my concerns. That's why as soon as I could get vaccinated, I was, and encouraged all my staff to, and they all are. And I have been encouraging my band members to that are playing. They're playing lots of different places, greatly outdoor concerts, which is tremendous. Last year in 2020, I think the Parks Department did a tremendous job nurturing live music outside in all their venues. It was really exponentially good, and this year it is too. And it was more needed last year because no one could go inside. And I found myself outside at Parks Department things when it was really cold, or when they did the Final Four, they did outdoor, it was Gang, I think, outdoor music in 5 or 6 different venues. I mean, some days it was like winter, but I went to every single one to support the music. I saw my customers out there. You know, we all had masks on and multi-layers on, but the fact that those entities created live music venues outside and hosted it, paid for it, everybody got paid. That was the best. That made our city survive.
We've had a lot of conversations in the newsroom since we've come back about what the public perception of downtown is and whether or not, I mean, there's still a lingering sense of downtown being a very dangerous place or just an undesirable place to go now. Is that something that concerns you, that downtown has taken kind of a reputation hit?
Through the years, there's always been an ebb and flow of how people that don't live there feel about downtown relative to safety. I think because of COVID and the fact that everyone was restricted in their movement, then sometimes bad actors had the free rein. Oftentimes when a place is busy, active and whatever, that's not an opportunity to make mischief or have gunplay or rob something or whatever. And the best part is when more people are gathered, there's certainly less crime. You don't see that. And I'm, of course, worried about that reputation. But even the conversation, Star editorial the other day, the announcement of the new 23-story building going up across from Roberts Park Church, all residential, and potentially even part of the city-county building when the government, when the courts and police move to the new center, part of that maybe being residential. That's all really positive stuff for people living downtown, all walking distance, in this case, from Mass Ave or down to South Meridian or whatever. People living here 24 hours a day, maybe they'll commute to a lab in the suburbs, that's okay, but they're coming down and spending their life quality time downtown. Mm-hmm. The fact that Bottle Works opened up during the pandemic has been a tremendous, that's the northeast anchor of our 1 mile diagonal.
Massachusetts Avenue.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really fabulous. I like it. I've been to the movie there. I go to the hot yoga place on the ground floor. Been to the garage hall, the new Cunningham restaurant that's in there. All the other venues there, the local food court stands that are tremendous. I mean, it's really great. It's now busy a lot. And then with more announcements of stuff going just on the northeast corner up north of Mass Avenue of where the Circle City Industrial Complex is. That's a tremendous venue there that's, you know, hitting its stride now. And then that's what brought another development on the other side of the tracks. I mean, that's kind of how it happens. That's how all of downtown has happened over the past 40-some years.
Yeah, so yeah, you bought the Chatterbox 39 years ago.
Yeah, May 82.
For 30 seconds, tell people what Mass Ave was like in 1982.
Well, it's still, if you go the real curb to the real curb, it's 100 feet right of way. And that was three lanes of traffic in and three lanes of traffic out. So in the morning, the north side of the street, the inbound lanes, you couldn't park there from 6 to 9. And in the afternoon, my side, three outbound lanes, you couldn't park there from 3 to 6. So that was just crazy. I mean, it was white flight to the suburbs. It was that kind of city planning that happened when the interstates came in and so on. It was just, there's so many levels of conversation we could have about this, but it was essentially abandoned except for the little bars, the little restaurants. The Star News building was there. That was a big anchor for my business and our business. All the little bars, and then little manufacturing places up and down the street, and a lunchtime places to eat. There was hardly any dinner stuff downtown at the time because people didn't eat dinner downtown. Hmm. And it was relatively abandoned. So I just wanted to buy a building. Oh, well, a bar comes with it with a liquor license. Oh, well, we're closing because bars at that time, they opened at 7 or 8 in the morning for the third shift worker that got off, because all little factories all around Mass Avenue and Park Street and over at College, those workers had three shifts, you know, so you would see we got the first shift workers and third shift workers. So we opened at 7 in the morning and closed about 8 at night. Well, as a young architect working for a firm, I'd come down there to look at my investment and we'd be closing. It's like, well, that's no fun. You know, how can I have fun doing that? You know, I couldn't leave at 5 because if my work wasn't done, I'd leave at 6:30 or 7 and then get there. So it was my idea to bring in live music to add to the bar because that's my contribution. It was named Chatterbox and had been previous owner had her for 41 years. I'm closing in on his record. But I added the music. So within the first 18 months, we kept adding a trial here. There's a little blues here, a little jazz here, that kind of thing. And then we started having music every night of the week.
Wait a second. Has it been continuously operating for 80 years?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that puts you up there.
Well, not Slippery Noodle.
No, not Slippery Noodle, but that was there since the Civil War.
Yeah, yes, yes. Yeah. So even the old point, now Tavern at the Point, that was 1870s.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah, right. Something like that.
So you're not even the oldest on your block.
No. Well, and Stout Shoes, 1886. Yeah. You know, in that building, same family, I think they're fifth generation now, 1886. So Chatterbox Building built in 1898. So we're 23 years right now? 123 years old. Wow. Something like that.
So from 39 years ago to today, when you look up and down Massachusetts Avenue, I mean, well, number one, it's almost unrecognizable. And I mean, you kind of stole my thunder a little bit because I was going to ask you about this. I mean, you've got a $300 million multi-use development, the Bottle Works, anchoring what used to be, just an empty bus yard.
Yes.
At the top of Mass Ave. There have been all kinds of residential apartment, I think some condo development up and down the street. There are quintupled the number of places to eat, places to drink. Did you think 39 years ago that was even possible?
Certainly no, but I was early on serving on the Neighborhood Association, which was, RARP, Riley Area Revitalization Program, started by the churches, downtown churches, because their congregations were moving, they were going out, and they said, we have to make sure our neighborhood gets back together so that we can build a new congregation and keep our churches here. So that was the motivation initially. And of course, at that time, I'm not sure when IPS took over the Coca-Cola plant, but that had always been something that was underutilized, that was something we saw as a great asset, especially because it was listed on the National Register of Historic Places and a contributing structure to our whole avenue, which is on the National Register. All of Mass Avenue is, so nationally recognized. So the great point is we always wanted something to happen with Coca-Cola, but it's take 40 years to do it.
Yeah, and that became Bottle Works.
Yeah.
Right. How much of a role did the Chatterbox play in making that area viable?
Well, I think because we added the live music and we were a special venue and then opened late at night, that kind of proved it was safe. I mean, it was more abandoned than anything, those early days. I mean, storefronts were boarded up. Yes, there were people that had had too much to drink and they slept in the storefront. Well, you know them by name after a couple of weeks. You know, Joe, come on, we're going to get you, sit up, and you know where your house is. I can walk you over there. And it was a social service kind of atmosphere for the early pioneers. And the person that was most responsible for me actually buying that, there were actually two people, a woman that was a architectural intern at the firm I worked for, her name was Mary King, and she was working at Ball State on her architectural history project. So summertime she worked, but then when she was done, she would continue to work on her National Register nomination for all of Mass Avenue. She came in contact by virtue of her school project with Scott Keller of Acquisition Restoration Corporation, who was purchasing apartment buildings downtown and slowly renovating them, utilizing the federal tax credits that were created during the bicentennial. So 1976 to 81, there were lots of things happening, and Mary gave me Scott Keller's phone number. I left a message. He called me back, lectured me for 30 minutes to 45 minutes. I didn't know this guy. But it all made sense, and he said, if you make your choice to come in now, there's lots happening all around you with good, positive things and direction, and you will not be alone. It will not be a bad investment. And it was beautiful. It all has come true. I mean, and those were the anchors, the renovation, restoration, and then we proved early on that it was safe late at night, that you could come down and listen to really great jazz music. And the Star News people were some of our great promoters because, number one, they would be there socially themselves, but then there would be a story here or a picture there, or it became newsworthy, so then everybody else was reading about it too.
And city staff, I think, would also frequent the bar, which is helpful, you know, in getting their attention.
Yeah, absolutely. Another great champion who worked for Dick Lugar when he was mayor was Bob Beckman, then evolved into F.C. Tucker. But he also worked with Scott Keller before he went to F.C. Tucker as a real estate person. So he was like this cheerleader advocate for downtown and development. And F.C. Tucker, by virtue of him being there, they were advocates as well. So people were thinking about, we're going to have our meetings downtown. We're going to move our office downtown. I want to live downtown. So I've lived downtown for 37 years, you know, and it was like, great. You know, I walk home from the bar at 2 o'clock in the morning. Number one, I know where I'm going. But number two, it's like, there's a lot of people out. And it's safer when there's lots of people. And, you know, just be, have some common sense. Mm-hmm.
So now when you walk by, or when you walk down Massachusetts Avenue, I mean, I still kind of get blown away by just the scale of what's there now. And then I walk by the Chatterbox, and it feels smaller.
Oh, yeah.
What is the role of the Chatterbox when it reopens on Mass Ave?
I think to continue its legacy of a cultural institution for jazz incubation, jazz playing, jazz musicians, white, black, male, female, all ages, all skill levels to be able to play there. So that's going to continue to be the role that I see us doing. I can't expand any. It would just change the space and the feel. And part of it is during the unrest early on in May of last year, when businesses were boarding up for safety reasons, insurance reasons, and so on, again, the Arts Council stepped in to have murals done on these buildings. And that was just a tremendous thing. Rather than a boarded up look, this was an art look over the boards. And Julia Mooney Moore is now making arrangements with the artist that did the one on mine for it to come down. It goes into a collection. It's still his intellectual property. I gave up the rights to the wood, which is just fine. And then some, I believe, are already on display at the State Museum. That's possible. I'm not exactly sure where, but some are. And there may be a rotating kind of exhibit. The artist that did mine, his moniker is Easy I, the letter Easy I. So it goes by Easy, and his last name is Underwood. So Easy, when he tags a space place, that's him. And it's beautiful. It just was beautiful. His inspiration was one of the superhero movies, which is really great and very stylized and really beautiful. So it was really cool. And we're happy to have had it. It's still identified as Chatterbox, even though it's got that beautiful mural on it. As an aside, we also met with the Arts Council. They have that program that's throughout the city called Bookmarks for Famous Authors. Mm-hmm. And, of course, a block away is Kurt Vonnegut. Across the street from me is Mari Evans in murals. And an artist who was a poet, the prison poet, Etheridge Knight, in the late 1980s, held his Free People's Poetry Workshop in the Chatterbox before the jazz after work. So it's very historic for that reason. Now, he lived in Barton Towers just down the block. So the Bookmark program has a marker down there talking about him. But on the side of my building, we're going to be working on a mural of Etheridge Knight. So that's going to be cool.
Oh, that's awesome. What's the timing on that, you think?
Probably it'll take about a year. We had our first in-person on-site meeting, and there's matching funds through the Arts Council, which is great. And we as a group, and I'm just a subset advisor, and I pledge to donate. We have to raise about $25,000 total. And there's a cultural district identity mural on the side of my building that was done when downtown Indy did cultural district identities all over. There were three of them on Mass Avenue. I had one on the side of my building, and it's a very stable base. I forget the name of the material, but it's got an aluminum basis to it, which makes it rigid and flat, and then plastic on the front, which is paintable. And then they seal it so that if someone graffitis it, you can wipe the graffiti off. Well, it's sort of in the shape of the state of Indiana, not really. And I think it was slightly intentional because it has sort of paint drips and it has a keyboard and all that, but it's not maintained, and it's no longer serviceable for that because the identities are already set. And we all identify ourselves in that way. We're Mass Ave District, and Broad Ripple is this, and Fountain Square, Fletcher Place, and Wholesale, and so on. So that will be likely the structural basis for the mural to go upon it.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
That's a good reason to come back downtown.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, best of luck.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for making the time.
I appreciate it, Mason. Thank you very much.
My thanks again to David Andercheck. Hey, before you get on with the rest of your week, I wanted to draw your attention to several strong stories in the latest print edition of IBJ. First up, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, Mickey Shuey and Susan Orr ask when downtown's major employers plan to bring back their workers to the extent they think is necessary in the post-pandemic world. 2 years ago, more than 150,000 people worked downtown, but office towers now are only about 50% occupied. And we know that they're not all coming back, and some of those who are coming back won't be coming back full time. Also in this week's issue, John Russell explores the surge in demand for alternative energy infrastructure and the corresponding hiring spree in Indianapolis-based Infrastructure and Energy Alternatives, Inc. And Emily Ketterer dives into the state's plans to invest $57 million in its parks, forests, and trails, including the first new state park inn in more than 80 years. And again, you can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business, community, and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com, click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.